You're watching Straight Talk Africa on the Voice of America. I'm Heidi Adams. Hello there and welcome. There's a lot of talk these days about the future of work and the many ways the pandemic has transformed how and where we do our jobs. But COVID-19 has also pushed millions around the world into unemployment and poverty. African countries now face a unique challenge, providing its large, youthful workforce with good, secure jobs in a post-pandemic world. This week, we discuss the future of finding work in Africa. We'll also profile a one-of-a-kind African university that says it's training the leaders Africa has been waiting for. I'll bring you my conversation with the Africa Leadership University's Veda Sunasi as we talk about higher education with a higher purpose. Straight Talk Africa starts now. We begin in Africa's most industrialized nation, South Africa. That country has one of the highest unemployment rates in the world, 34%. South Africa's economy has been battered by the pandemic. Now concerns about the Omicron variant could potentially bring more restrictions and more uncertainty. And just like elsewhere in the world, women bear the brunt of the economic hardship. The unemployment rate among black women in South Africa stands at 41%. Even the skilled and educated struggle to either find work or are at risk of losing the jobs they have. Linda Givtash is in Johannesburg for us with this report.
Rebecca Mwale has been searching for a job to no avail since January. The recent graduate from a supply chain management program was already working in the sector when the pandemic struck and she found herself laid off.
I apply almost every day, but the responses I'm getting, I'm sure I've applied more than 30 times since, but I've only gotten like 2 responses back. There's not much out here. I even started applying outside the country.
About 585,000 South Africans lost their job last quarter, a period marked by strict COVID-19 lockdowns. The government says the total number of job seekers has reached 7.8 million, while an additional 3.3 million people have given up searching. While the pandemic is taking an economic toll, economists say it's compounded with a historically bleak situation.
I don't think we've turned the corner. I think unemployment is likely to continue creeping up. And unfortunately, it's women that will bear the brunt of all this.
2 decades of experience as a flight attendant for South Africa's national carrier didn't spare Charity Mokimane from job cuts last year. She never dreamt of retraining, but she didn't want to leave her husband as the family's sole breadwinner.
You know, when you keep hearing places are shedding jobs, then you think, oh, you know, I can't. I just decided to maybe try and look at other avenues of making money.
She adopted her mother's passion for baking and started selling cakes from her home. Economists say this type of informal entrepreneurship isn't captured in employment data. It means people like Mokimane are still getting by.
And I feel also slightly more in control of what happens to my life. And whatever happens, people have to eat.
But for young job seekers like Mwale, the disruption has curtailed dreams of building a career. The stress has also taken a toll on her mental health.
I did not envision myself depressed and sitting at home. It was not in my plans. I did not even imagine.
South Africa's economy did grow in the first quarter of this year, but economists warn unemployment will remain high for the foreseeable future. Faced with uncertainty, Mwale says all she can often do is pray. Linda Givtash for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Now, when it comes to high unemployment, especially among young people, South Africa is a bit of an outlier. While Africa has the world's youngest population, studies show that globally, the continent actually has the lowest unemployment rate among people aged 15 to 24. But most of Africa's young people have informal jobs. Many are underemployed or are poorly paid. So it's that much harder to work your way out of poverty, especially when there's a lack of social safety nets. Now there is concern that the pandemic is creating a lockdown generation. And African economies are now faced with a rather big challenge: how to provide their large, energetic workforce with jobs that are decent, productive, and secure. Where will those jobs come from? And that's what I discuss with my guest this week, the future of finding work in Africa. Jerusalem and Amolo, thank you so much for joining me. Amolo Ngweno is the CEO of BFA Global, a consulting firm specializing in financial inclusion in the digital economy. She joins us from the Kenyan capital of Nairobi. And Jerusalem Siba is a research fellow and private sector specialist working on African development issues. She's based here in Washington, D.C. Ladies, a warm welcome to you. Amolo, please start us off here. Africa's collective youth unemployment rate is often referred to as a ticking time bomb. Is it really a time bomb? And can you draw us a picture of who exactly is unemployed? What's their age and what are their education and skill levels?
The first question is it a ticking time bomb? And I think there's obviously two sides to that coin, which is the population bulge of young people who are coming of age in Africa over the next 10 years. And it's going to be a huge population, number of people entering this prime age group for work. And there is a big question about what are those people going to be doing, considering that there is already significant unemployment and especially underemployment, where people are doing work that's less than full-time or less than fully engaging of their skills. So I think that it's a big challenge for the continent. It can also be seen in the other direction, which is it's the demographic dividend that we will have this young population at a time when the rest of the world have aging populations. And that youth dynamism, energy, economic activity could and should produce actually sustained boom while that population grows up and spends 30 to 40 working years, which is more or less the picture that happened in Asia, where while their population was very young is when they had this enormous economic growth and catch up in terms of living standards and occupations.
In Jerusalem, what is the disconnect here? Is it that there are not enough people with the right skills to get the jobs that are available, or are there just not enough jobs for the sheer numbers of people looking for work in African countries?
I think it's both, actually. It's so as Amolo mentioned, there is a rapidly growing population, youthful population. Depending on how you see it, it can be a positive thing. It's an energetic, youthful population, more receptive to technological development, as well as more adaptive compared to reskilling an existing workforce retrenched from different global developments. So I would like to take a more optimistic view of having a more energetic workforce, which we would like to prepare, invest on for the future, the skills of the future of African continent. Perhaps there is also a story of mismatch between the skills demanded and the available skills. One of the major complaints, if you interview some companies working on Africa, is having to find a skilled workforce immediately catering for their demand. But I would put the major responsibility on creating the jobs, large-scale jobs that are capable of absorbing the youthful population now and in the future.
Amolo, how did we get to this place of a youth bulge coupled with high unemployment? Is there a backstory of specific circumstances unique to the continent? How did we get here?
I think we got on the development train later for historic historic reasons having to do with colonialism and where we all were in 1900. And to some extent, the shadow of that is continuing to the present time. So all over the world, the growth rate of population has declined, including in Africa. It's not that we're still having very, very high population growth rate, but we have the positive effect of children are surviving. So they're growing up, the past generations who also had large numbers of children, they're growing up. And what we find is that there is the lack, decades now of less, let me not say lack of, but less investment in the things that create jobs. One of those is education. So there's been a huge investment in education, but still the high school education in many countries across the continent is not even half of students go to high school. And then you have a generation who are less able to take up the jobs of the modern world, whether they're digital jobs or work in factories or restaurants or the economy in general requires certain educational skills. And that's only increasing. That's not likely to decline. So where we are is the consequence of where we've been. But at the same time, we are at a moment when there's more education than there has ever been. There are more digital tools available. There's more the Africa Continental Free Trade Area. There's more opportunity. It's really the question of whether these things that are going in the right direction, can they catch up enough to meet the needs of this huge, growing, a young adult population who need jobs, activities, occupations, and ways to create incomes.
And this is a question for both of you, but I'll ask you first, Jerusalem. What are the jobs of the future? Where are they, and what skills will be needed to get those jobs and to do them?
Those are big but great set of questions to discuss. Just to build off what Amalo mentioned about youth unemployment, I think some of it is to be expected because of where we are in our economic development. Because we are moving out of agriculture in our cities, in our urban labor markets, are not ready to create the formal jobs that we want to absorb this excess labor. By definition, we're gonna have to face a lot of unemployment issues because of where the structure of our economies and our labor markets are in the stage of development of most of African countries. So the future, definitely the future of African labor market is going to be shaped by global mega trends like digitalization, climate change, and urbanization. We have a broad understanding of what kind of which sectors are going to evolve in what direction. I would like to say it's more urban and it's more for the lack of investment on our formal labor market, it's going to be more informalized, but in urban jobs demanding certain set of skills in manufacturing and services. And those are some of the jobs also under threat from the global digitalization megatrend that we need to address.
Amalo, how do you see it? I mean, can you help us create a list of sorts for young people trying to figure this out? What and where are the jobs of the future?
So for people at the lower end of the education scale, I think Jerusalem is completely correct that the informal sector is... It's huge. It's 80% of employment at present. And while that is certain to decline as urbanization increases, that's where people with a low level of education are able to find work that requires low skills and low integration with formal systems. For people with a bit more education, obviously the trends towards digitalization make the job market more fluid, more accessible to even for international type of jobs. The gig economy, e-commerce, those are all going to be larger contributors to the economy than certainly they are today. And we hope that they're going to actually be a significant source of employment for this rising youth population, especially as they enter the city. But still, I think the fundamental sectors of all our economies are going to continue to remain in agriculture and construction, small share in manufacturing, but we hope that will increase. And then the big services industry that includes, you know, the informal sector, restaurants, manufacturers, hair salons, repair people. The industries that sustain us now are going to be the same industries of the future. We just hope that they're going to be more digital and more productive so that people can get higher incomes out of them.
And I'll come back later to talk more about the digital economy and the digital divide. But first, I want to focus on the pandemic and social safety nets. Here in the United States, and we've seen some of this in South Africa as well, we hear presidents talk about a relief package. And I can't help but wonder about countries where this is not even a real option. What has the pandemic taught us, Jerusalem, about the state of social protections and safety nets and the lack of them in African countries, especially for those who work in the informal sector?
So I had a chance to look at this for some of the East African countries, looking at how COVID has disrupted the private sector, and to look at some of the fiscal and monetary measures governments put in place globally. And I've seen some of the reports saying that like most advanced countries came up with a web list of social protection for their firms, for their companies, including tax deferral, wage subsidies, and other protecting strategic sectors in the airline, in the healthcare sector, and many telecom, including telecom. But if you look at the amount, the share of our GDP spent for protecting the private sector in Africa, it's very minimal compared to some of the advanced countries and the amount of money in the order of more than 10% of their GDPs were spent on protecting firms, both small firms, vulnerable firms, and also large corporates. So targeting was also an issue, and some of the stimulus package payments did not reach the most vulnerable firms, informal, women-owned, mostly affected firms didn't get any significant amount of support in Africa. And also some of them were short-lived. Countries like Kenya put their tax measures like to end somewhere in January this year. Those countries which continued to give these relief packages end up facing fiscal sustainability issues. So there is a grave list of challenges there in terms of putting social protection for job creators of the continent.
And in that vein, Amolo, what, in your view, were the new problems that the pandemic has brought with it? And what were the existing problems that it merely revealed?
Yeah, I don't know if it's a new or an existing problem, but the fact that COVID has had such a heavy impact on women, that women have been, and you've seen this obviously in the West as well, where women have the responsibility not only for somehow keeping up income for the family, but also all of the childcare and the elder care, sick people. And what we've seen also in some of our research is that when the families have lost their incomes, the woman is still responsible for putting food on the table, even though everybody knows that we've lost our income, but somehow that's a key responsibility that weighed very heavy on women. And I think all the statistics show that whereas there's some sectors like e-commerce where they've grown strongly during the pandemic, that is for male participants, and women participants have been harmed. So I think it's revealed and exaggerated an age-old problem in the structure of the economy or the structure of the firm or the family, that women have had the much more difficult time during the pandemic, and we'll see how the recovery will go as well in terms of will women have the opportunities and ability to recover that men will have.
I want to turn now to the digital economy. Of course, it's a term or phenomenon that we hear about all the time, especially in relation to the African continent. I'm curious, if the future is digital, but we still see this digital divide, chronic problems on the continent with lack of internet penetration, lack of high-speed internet and high mobile data costs on the continent. How accessible and inclusive is this digital economy, and how inclusive will it be in the future, especially for low-income parts of populations in African countries?
Just to build on Amalo's point on existing or new challenge that COVID has exposed, one mechanism that firms have used was through the digital. So they have tried to diversify in terms of tackling their markets and getting some access to markets through the digital. The digital divide was critical problem that the COVID has also exposed. And you can see that the difference between different companies, those who adopted and who became resilient were those who had to rely on the digital front. But increasingly we see higher adoption of digital technologies. I think which countries can build on to accelerate the digital development front. If you look at some of the recovery package of African countries, they have built in digital infrastructure investment as part of the resilience building. So one hopes that these investments will tackle some of the affordability, the pricing issues of access to internet, and also the reach to the most vulnerable who are excluded by digital divide currently.
I think the mobile money is an African success story, which is one of the underpinning infrastructure for the digital economy. So African countries are leading in the world in terms of adoption of mobile money. So I think that's it's an important component, both of this resilience that Jerusalem just mentioned during the pandemic, and also the future of digital economy activities and jobs for young people.
We often hear talk about goals for 2030. It's so close we can start counting on our fingers here. The African Union and the World Bank have pledged to connect every person, every business, and every government to the internet by 2030 through the Digital Economy for Africa initiative. 2030 is about 8 years away, and COVID has set economies around the world back. And so if it's taken this long for us to get only about a third of the continent connected, how will the digital divide be closed by 2030? Jerusalem, is that realistic? And how will the continent get there?
I'm hoping the Continental Free Trade Area and Agreement is building on primarily on the digital technology. So there is this momentum of digitalization and adoption of digital technologies. And at the same time, countries are working not just on the national digital infrastructure, but also working towards building the regional infrastructure. Just to give you an example of the One Area Network, which is trying to make up internet access and international calls accessible, especially for the landlocked countries. I'm hoping building on this regional collaboration and also harmonization of trades, especially through the digital e-commerce platform, I'm hoping this would fast track the goal of achieving universal access to the digital infrastructure, not just for those who can afford it, but also universally, right? As you mentioned, COVID has taken us back not just on this digital front, but also on SDGs and other visions of the continent. But having that in mind, we should build on existing and new initiatives like digitalization, increased adoption of digitalization, and also the new momentum of creating regional trade, including regional digital trade. So we should capitalize on those.
Amolo, what's your take?
I agree with everything Jerusalem said. I think there's a momentum, and it's become sort of a world standard, and that momentum is increasing, and COVID has given it all a push. So I think it's necessary, and governments feel that it's necessary to invest in and increase the digital infrastructure. So I think on balance and for most countries, we're going to see substantial success towards those targets.
Now, there's been a huge focus on STEM and how science, technology, engineering, and mathematics are really the future. But everyone might not be good at maths or science. I, for one, am a walking, breathing testimony to that. But the subjects students take at school can impact the direction they take at university, Technicon, or any sort of vocational school they might attend in future, or whatever they do with their lives after high school. What would you say to those students about where they should focus their energies, Aeroslim?
Those are difficult questions, even for those entering the labor market. I think we need to build our capacity in terms of clearly saying these are these 10 growing industries in the coming decade or two. And also, so if we have a clear idea of the skills of the industries of the future, then it's easier for youth to build on the skills of the future needed by those industries. We need to have broadly specific skills catering for these growing industries. It can be in green industries, green skills, or service, ICT related service sectors, business sectors. So once we have a clear understanding of where we are going in terms of the next a decade or two, it would be easier to have for the youth to build on the specific skills and to feed into a constant pipeline of talent to serve for those industries. We should also be on the lookout on the general skills needed other than the digital, also to have more like life skill related adaptability, resilience, and like generic skills needed in the future, given that there are a lot of uncertainties as to how our labor markets are adapting to these mega global trends and as to how African labor markets are shaped by those trends.
Amolo, a very serious and heartbreaking phenomenon, in my view at least, is what we're seeing play out in the unemployment lines in many African countries, specifically South Africa. Unemployed graduates. Now, we're always telling young people on the continent to stay in school, get an education if you want a better future. Then they do that only to then be educated and unemployed. So what can be done, in your view, on the part of leadership, on the part of societies in the countries they are from? And what can they do to prepare for this uncertain job market to ensure that they don't become unemployed graduates?
Yeah, I think it's a tough thing because it's hard to put it on the youth and say, you know, you need to be responsible for your future, which in a way, you know, you do need to be responsible for your own future, but you're coming into a situation where especially formal employment is going to be difficult to obtain. And so I think some of those less academic subjects or themes or skills for entrepreneurship, for adaptability, for customer service and customer interaction, I think we've done a number of different studies with employers, and usually what they're unhappy with is not the technical skills that workers have, but it's their ability to be reliable and dependable and interact with the customers. And I think those are skills in any field that anyone would go into, whether it's you're the employer or the employee. If you have those reliability, dependability, customer orientation, and then it will be necessary for a good number of young people to be entrepreneurial. And it's necessary for the rest of society to support that through not only the education system, but making capital and opportunities available for entrepreneurship, which has been improving over the years, but is still obviously not ideal. So for young people, I think it's important to know that those non-academic skills are actually often the most important out there in the real world.
Amolo Ngweno and Aeroslim Siba, we're going to leave it there. Ladies, thank you so much for joining this discussion. I really appreciate it. And I thank you so much for your time.
Wonderful.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye.
And so we asked you on social media, what can and should governments do to create more education and job opportunities? Usman A. Kante from Monrovia in Liberia says the system of our education needs to be integrated with the modern ones that operate based on the needs of the employers and the industry. Jacob Njoroge from Mombasa in Kenya says there are more graduates than jobs available. Changes in the education system is the only thing that can alter this. Joshua Joseph says the root problem is not unemployment, but the fact that Africans do not possess their own natural resources, and most countries are not even privileged to elect their own leaders. Former colonialists' blessings are needed to do virtually anything in Africa. Mustafa Kone is in the US, but he's originally from Freetown in Sierra Leone. He thinks governments should implement programs that enable individuals to be self-employed, whether they are high school or college graduates. Small business creation should be supported and encouraged by the government. Muchi Mangena says free vocational training schools must be the number one priority, and also they must not be difficult to enroll in. An entry exam can determine what courses you're able to take. And this one from Masai Junior Zabron from Tanzania. So many things have to be done. First, promote industrial development since industries absorb a large number of employees. Secondly, invest and modernize the agricultural sector to attract a large number of graduates. And third, change the education system and curriculum from theoretical to more practical system in order for graduates to be well prepared to tackle a practical environment as soon as they graduate. Thank you so much for your comments. We really appreciate your input. And speaking of changing the education landscape, still ahead here on Straight Talk Africa, my conversation with Veda Sunasi from the Africa Leadership University and how they're cultivating, as they put it, the leaders who will transform Africa. We'll take you inside their campuses and their story next.
Health, wellness, sport, beauty, medical breakthroughs. Healthy Living cares about your well-being. What are the main health concerns in Africa and around the world? Find out the latest on coronavirus. Connect with our experts and ask them questions.
How long does the virus stay?
Join me, Lino Khmudu, in Washington, every week on Healthy Living, right here on VOA.
You're with Straight Talk Africa on VOA. Welcome back. When I first learned about the Africa Leadership University, I couldn't help but think, wow, I wish I had that kind of education. ALU says it's training the leaders who will transform Africa, equipping them with the skills and the networks to help solve some of the continent's greatest challenges. The university opened its doors in Mauritius in 2015 and now has another campus in Rwanda. But long-term, ALU hopes to build 25 campuses in major cities across the continent, producing 3 million young African leaders and innovators over the next 50 years. And since I like good ideas about good education just as much as anyone, I had quite a few questions for ALU's Executive Director, Veda Sunasi. Before we get to that conversation, let's hear from the university students.
I feel like ALU was the school destined for me. I've always known about the state of the continent from a very theoretical standpoint. And I feel like ALU is the school that was going to offer a unique perspective and unique understanding of the state of the continent as it is now.
Coming from Ethiopia and also coming from straight from high school and to get this quality education, world-class education, that's why I feel really lucky to be part of ALU.
Now that I'm finally here, I get the opportunity to specialize and understand certain aspects of the continent, like education, urbanization, job creation, and the likes. I'm really excited to be here because I finally get the opportunity to not only get all these things from a theoretical, broad standpoint, but then to narrow all these things down to what exactly needs to be done for the benefit of the continent.
Finding yourself in a diverse community of around 38 countries
It's quite interesting. I personally love it. I enjoy it. When you read on the logo where they say we do hard things, it's actually true. You're not going to be disappointed. To me, gradually, I'll say ALU was a dream come true.
Coming to ALU was so unexpected. For me, it was like a dream come true, like something unexpected, but I feel like I'm in the right place.
This is Africa's Ivy League. But instead of getting admitted because of your SAT scores or because of how much money you have or which family you come from, the main criteria for getting into this university will be what is the potential that you have for transforming Africa.
I expect to engage in a lot of projects locally, regionally, and projects that can impact Africa as a whole before I can even graduate.
I just feel like it's a workplace more than like a classroom.
If I could go back 5 years down the line and I am a high school graduate and I'm trying to choose where to go, I would choose ALU because I know that at ALU I can meet other young Africans like me, and so I can have a network across Africa of friends, of collaborators.
Even though we all come from different backgrounds and different cultures, religions, I feel like we have lots of things in common. And the most important thing that we have in common is our love for Africa.
I'm excited about meeting young leaders, new people that we can share ideas with.
My classmates are super passionate and dedicated to changing the continent.
The staff, the students, everybody gets to sit together and like talk. Everybody cares about what we think.
We chose Mauritius as our first location for our university because it's one of the most stable countries, not just in Africa, but in the world. It has all the kind of things that would make a world-class institution, and it's one of the most beautiful countries in the world. I believe that part of getting a university education is not just about learning. It's about having the time of your life. And so when you come to Mauritius, it makes the student experience so much more enjoyable.
We are founders. We are the first set of students here. So it behooves on us to create the culture that we'll live on 50 years from now.
The students have access into building a university that they want, unlike any other university. Hence, I believe ALU was the perfect university for me.
Welcome to ALU.
Bienvenue à ALU.
Beta, what a great pleasure it is to have you on the show.
Thank you.
Let's start off with ALU's backstory. What was the idea behind its beginnings, and what was missing from the tertiary education system in Africa that ALU is uniquely positioned to change, you think?
Certainly. Well, the African Leadership University was actually born out of the African Leadership Academy, another entity which is part of the African Leadership Group. And our vision as a group is to, you know, transform the continent through development of ethical entrepreneurial leaders on the continent. So the African Leadership Academy is a high school based in Johannesburg, South Africa, where we bring the brightest students from all over the continent, about 100 of them, put them in this program before they go on to university. And one of the things that we noticed very quickly was that while we were able to attract thousands of students from all over the continent, we could only admit a handful into our academy. And very often we had to see those students go on to pursue, you know, better university opportunities outside of Africa. Hence, we, you know, started investigating, but what exactly is the problem in higher ed in Africa, right? Only to find out that, you know, we are the continent that has the lowest rate of young people finishing high school going into higher ed. Only 8% of Africans completing high school go on to university. And that's 8% of those who complete high school, right? We're not even talking about how many do end up completing high school, right? And, you know, we all know that we are the youngest continent, you know, in the world right now. The median age of the African youth is about 19 years old, which means that out of a population of 1.2 billion people, there's about 600 million who are under the age of 19, who are going to be seeking, higher education very soon, and many who are seeking at the moment. And this is a continent that has had, you know, leadership fail it for a very long time. And we believe very strongly that we need a whole new generation of young ethical entrepreneurial leaders. Why ethical entrepreneurial leaders? Ethical because we need leaders who are driven by values, driven by integrity, leaders who are here, who understand that their job as leaders is for the greater good, is to serve for the prosperity of the African continent. Why entrepreneurial? Is because we need problem solvers. For far too long, we've sat down and, you know, pointed the finger of blame towards our leaders, rightly so in many instances. But, you know, I think it's time that we take ownership of these challenges and also the opportunities that the continent, you know, offer, right? So entrepreneurial leaders are people who don't see problems as problems. They see opportunities in problems, right? So they are problem solvers. So we are in the business, for lack of a better word, of developing problem solvers for the continent. And why leaders? Because they need to take initiative, right? We need them to be able to see problems and opportunities and then be proactive about it.
Right? Now, from looking at your outward-facing promotional materials, ALU seems to have the makings of a world-class Ivy League-style learning institution. It really does look like a place any student would want to go. Yet your website says ALU is not for everyone. What does that mean, and who exactly is ALU designed for?
The first thing I want to say is I've seen ALU being quoted as the Ivy League of Africa or the Harvard of Africa. I went to an Ivy League school, and I'm a leader in this university. I can tell you we don't aspire to replicate what the Ivy Leagues are. And they've done incredible work. There's no question about that. But this is not what we are about, right? We're really about, you know, training young people for a very specific purpose, which is to have impact on the continent, is to really address some of these challenges and tap into some of these opportunities that exist, right? We have an approach that is very different from a traditional approach, right? In the way that you would get in an Ivy League institution. Learning happens best by doing. That learning is experiential in nature. So our program is designed in such a way that our students, as early as their first year, get immersed into the real world. In their first year, our students already work with real companies. So what we will usually do is, you know, we will reach out to a company that is trying to tackle a problem either within the company itself or, you know, a need in society. And that manager will present the case to our students. And our facilitators, and that's the other thing I want to highlight, that ALU will believe that our job is to facilitate learning, right? So we don't have people who are here to lecture. We have people who are here to facilitate, to curate learning. So our facilitators then work with our students, equip them with the skills, and help them understand how to, you know, scope out the project, do the research, and present your solutions. And then they get feedback from that manager. They go back to the drawing board. They incorporate the feedback. They come back with a second round of solutions, and then a third round. And they do these types of projects multiple times, such that by the end of their first year, they are already gaining real-world experience. Then they go on to doing an internship. We are very lucky to have a very extensive network across the continent of Africa that we leverage and create opportunities for our students to go and practice those skills. We're really trying to prepare our students for the 21st century, and it's a very different time in human history, right, where it is important for people to learn how to learn because, you know, so much is changing in the world.
And speaking of challenges, one challenge we do have in African countries, especially the one I'm from, South Africa, you should know you've lived there too, is the high cost of tuition and how that hampers young people's access to tertiary education. Now, ALU looks great, but it does look expensive. Is it affordable? I mean, especially for someone who might possess all these leadership qualities and all the potential that you outline, but is perhaps not in the financial position to afford this kind of education and access.
So, two things. Is this affordable? Affordability is also relative, isn't it? Right? Is an ALU education more affordable relative to an Ivy League education? Most definitely. Is an ALU education more affordable than what one might get at public university in their home country? You know, probably somewhat more expensive, right? So part of our vision is to make education accessible, right? We are, you know, in the business of, we are a non-profit institution that really is, you know, doing this to try to amplify the impact of our work by really putting a model out there that we think can be replicated relatively easily by others, right? We hope to train 3 million leaders in the next 10 years, but 3 million leaders, when I mentioned earlier, we've got 600 million who need this this type of opportunity, is nothing. But hopefully, right, hopefully, others can also see in what we're doing the value. And the way we're trying to make our education affordable and accessible is by really leveraging technology. You go into the real world and you make your learning immersive. You're using technology to do work synchronously and asynchronously virtually. But now as you go into the real world, into your respective city, wherever you come from, right? We intend to be in the process at the moment of building, setting up what we're calling these hubs, right? So then even though you go back to your home country, you have these hubs where you can commune with your peers. When you're in your home community, in addition to all these other things that I mentioned, you're able to plug into, the city or community where you are based to do experiential learning, in-person learning. You're able to be in one of those hubs to do social learning with your peers. You are able to welcome, visiting faculty and subject matter experts and learn from them. You are also able to be closer to home and avoid having to pay fees like, accommodation and transportation and flight and food, right? You could just commute from home. You could occasionally leverage, working from home as well, right? So it's through a combination of bringing learning closer to our students from the two motherships of Mauritius and Rwanda, by making learning more experiential in the communities where you intend to address the needs, the challenges, and tap into the opportunities that you've addressed, and keep you also closer to home. And by also adding technology on top of that, we believe we are able to provide a model that becomes suddenly a lot more affordable, accessible, but by still making sure that you're meeting these learning outcomes that will make you a very strong, problem solver who gets closer to fulfilling your mission. So in, the Ivy Leagues, as you describe, in many other institutions, as you enter, you need to declare your major. I am majoring in engineering. I am majoring in political science. At ALU, we're saying, no, declare your mission. My mission is to address the problem of, traffic congestion in my city. Right, that's my mission. My mission is to unlock the potential in the conservation industry in Africa.
Right, and I suppose it can't be something vague or broad, right? I mean, someone can't just come to you and say, I want world peace, let's make that happen. I take it must be a mission that is focused, clearly defined, or a problem or challenge that you can actually help solve, am I right?
Definitely, yeah, and this is where, our team is here to help somebody narrow down this, this big question. Great, we all want to solve for world peace, but how do you break this down into, bite sizes that you can actually manage and you can actually handle, right? And, remember one thing I said earlier, that at the end of the day, what we really want to make sure that our students also learn, in addition to these skills and these mindsets, is to learn how to learn. The research shows that 85% of the jobs in the year 2030 haven't been created yet. When I studied computer science, actually more than 12 years ago, the language that we were learning to program in is irrelevant today, right? And like that, there's gonna be so many more things that will change. So it doesn't mean that somebody who learned computer science at the time can't be a computer scientist today, but they learn how to learn the language of programming. So when a new one comes, they know how to do that, right? So the single most important skill we can give our students is this ability to learn how to learn, so they can then reinvent themselves, over time and over the years.
Veda, we have so many young people on the continent who are unemployed. Many are educated yet jobless. In your view, and from what you hear from ALU students, whose job is it to fix this problem? And where should the fixing start?
Where should the fixing start? I think in an ideal world, we would be turning to our leaders and expect or hope that they would be the one prioritizing the fixing. But I think we all know that that is more often than not the case. And I mentioned earlier, we provide our students with the tools to be ethical, entrepreneurial leaders. Emphasis here on entrepreneurial. Obviously, we're not expecting them to immediately step into leadership roles, right? But we hope that they do use these tools that we provide them to grow into these leadership positions, political or otherwise, right? I believe very strongly in intrapreneurship as well, that our learners can be influencers and change makers in existing systems and existing organizations. And actually, some of our students have taken it upon themselves to address these issues as entrepreneurs. Take the example of two of my students, Joseph from Tanzania, who set up this venture called Ruazi, which collects and provides data insights on the African market, right? And he got that idea through the data and decision course that they had to take at ALU. He has already built a company. He's only been graduated for about 2 years. He's built a company and is employing nearly 6,000 people across the continent of Africa, right? Take the example of Ashraf, right, who's from South Sudan, who he has built a social venture. He also sees the needs of and the gaps in education in his home country. So he's built this organization called Knowledge Arc, NOARC, which helps refugees by providing them with quality education, globally recognized high school diplomas from the US and vocational training, right? So as a learning institution, we obviously believe that, you know, the responsibility to educate and equip young people with these skills needed for them to be relevant in the job market is our responsibility. But we also believe that we want to develop them to be not just job seekers, but also job creators.
Veda, I see something very central to the vision you have for your students is that of good leadership. What is the most important thing you teach your students about good leadership? And what kind of leadership attributes do you believe the continent will need from this generation?
Yeah, I would say hands down, integrity, right? I think the one thing we've lacked for too long is integrity, right? And we know this, we experience this every single day, everywhere on the continent. Our integrity is tested over and over and over and over again. The opportunities to compromise on our integrity are there all the time. But it takes a leader with a very strong value system, with integrity being part of that value system, who is able to say no, right? There's a reason why in our value proposition, we very explicitly say we are here to develop ethical entrepreneurial leaders. We need to spell it out. We need our students to know the kinds of leaders we want them to be, right? We don't, because, you know, we've had lots of leaders on the continent. You know, all types of leaders. We've had our heroic leaders, we've had our freedom fighters, right? We've had our nation builders, but we've also had a number of very flawed leaders. I mean, we all are flawed. All leaders are flawed, right? But it's a question of, are you self-aware enough? Do you have enough emotional intelligence to know, you know, where your flaws are, right? How do you then, you know, complement your gaps as a leader? How do you make sure that you are surrounded by people who espouse to similar ethical standards, right? Because then when there is that sort of, you know, community accountability, right, it is less likely that people are going to give in to, you know, opportunities to compromise on their integrity. So for me, if that's one thing we learn how to fix on our continent, I think it will take us very, 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 very far.
Veda, thank you so much for your time. Great to speak to you.
Thank you. It was a pleasure. Take care.
And that was Veda Sonasi speaking to me from the Rwandan capital of Kigali. We're going to take a short break here, and when we come back, a 1-2 punch against drugs and crime. We'll show you how a former boxing champion in Zimbabwe is getting young people into the ring and off the streets. Stay with us.
Let's go.
Welcome back. It's no secret that any time there is high unemployment in a country, you're likely to find young people idle and vulnerable to crime. In Zimbabwe, a former boxing champion has stepped into the ring to help teach youth new skills and keep them away from drugs and crime. Columbus Mavunga brings us the story of the Mosquito Boxing School of Excellence in Harare.
24-year-old Anton Possible Mapako was a street fighter and drug user from this poor suburb of Mbare. But he says things have changed since he joined the Mosquito Boxing School of Excellence. And he credits the school's founder and coach, Jenika Arifonso.
I always say thank you, coach, when I started to say this statement. Why? Because I know he's not just a teacher of boxing, but he can change even your mind about the bad things you think to do. He can change you.
44-year-old Alfonso started the academy after he left boxing. As a fighter, he was known as Mosquito for the way he would sting his opponents. Now, his focus is on helping troubled youths.
I'm in this project because I wanted to remove kids from drug abuse and womanizing and stealing, because there's a lot of crimes which are committed by these young guys.
Alfonso now has about 120 students divided into three groups per day. He hopes some become professional boxers. Zimbabwe government says substance abuse among youth is a scourge that needs to be addressed as soon as possible.
We are working with law enforcement agents to try and curb illicit substances coming into the country. And in terms of demand, we are working to try and educate members of the public around the dangers of engagement in illicit substance abuse.
Alfonso is working to set up programs in other poor townships and pull more youths away from drugs. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare, Zimbabwe.
Be sure to join me for the next Straight Talk Africa. We'll talk about the Nobel Prizes. Africa has had many illustrious and some controversial Nobel laureates. There was jubilation when Tanzanian-born novelist Abdulrazak Gurnah won the 2021 Nobel Prize in Literature. But how relevant are these awards to Africans? And are these institutions in step with the times? We'll also discuss whether it's time Africa had a Nobel-style awards of its own. Join me, Haiti Adams, on the next Straight Talk Africa. And that is where we'll end our show this week. Thank you so much to my guests for joining me and to all my VOA colleagues for their hard work on the show. Thank you for always watching and always listening. I'll see you next time. Go well. Goodbye.